From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Running a family business has both its joys and challenges. Are there secrets out there behind the successful family business? Cautionary tales from those that haven't worked out. In the hour ahead, we'll explore the world of family business, how you mix family and the bottom line, and how you keep them separate. How do you decide which of two siblings will take over the company? What do you do when that son-in-law just isn't working out? We'll hear from some family businesses in the Bay Area and talk with two leading family business experts. Blood relations and the bottom line. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. Starting your own business and then someday turning it into a family enterprise is a dream for many. Family businesses can be small mom-and-pop affairs or giant companies. They can be the stuff of stunning success or fractious failure. And it all starts with those two words, family and business. By definition, they have different imperatives. One is about the bottom line. One is about love and support. So how do you best blend the two? If you're lucky enough to get a family business going, then what happens when it's time to figure out which son or daughter will lead the company in the next generation? From raises to parking spaces, who to hire and who to fire, business decisions take on a different dimension when they're all family affairs. In this hour forum, we're going to hear from four different family businesses whose products range from cuisine to consulting, and we'll also get the views of two people who study and assist family businesses. Joining us first this hour, Kent Rhodes. He's visiting professor of leadership and ethics at Pepperdine University and an associate with the Family Business Consulting Group. Kent Rhodes, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Lou Lucaccini. He's adjunct professor and research associate at the School of Business's Gellert Family Business Center at the University of San Francisco. Lou Lucaccini, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Happy to have you both here, and we'll start getting our participation from our various family businesses in just a moment. But just to sort of set the stage on this, Kent Rhodes first, how do you separate what seem, at least on the surface, to be very different desires, one to make money, one to love and support your family?
That's a great question, and what's one of the areas where we spend a lot of our time with families, helping them learn to separate what is family and what is business. Because typically what happens is a family gets together and has this great idea, invest themselves and their finances into building a business, and a lot of times it winds up being way more successful than what they anticipated. And as the family is engaged in that process, they lose focus sometimes on the boundaries between what is the business and what is the family. And so being able to separate those and understand that regardless of whether or not there's a business, there'll always be a family.
But how do you make that separation? If your spouse is your spouse, your son or daughter are your children, they don't stop being your spouse, son or daughter between
right.
the hours of 9 to 5.
Right.
I mean, how do you make that separation?
Well, I think sometimes it's very practical, helping them understand that every mealtime doesn't need to be about discussing the business. Mm-hmm. Then, in fact, they need to think about creating space and time where they have rules even. We're not going to talk about business here. We're going to just be family in this environment. So it even can start at a very basic level like that of some very practical kind of strategies.
And what about within the workday itself, Lou Lucaccini? I mean, do you still treat that person as your spouse, son, daughter, brother, son-in-law? Or are they your, work colleague, employee, or boss?
Well, I think every business finds its own rules and ways to do things. Kent talks about separating out the two aspects of a family business. And I guess we call that, in the classroom, we call that a dual relationship or a dual diagnosis if it was a mental health sort of a situation or dual dependency. But a family business often is started because of a lifestyle decision, wanting to work with the people you love, and the textbook we use is Dennis Jaffe's book called Working with the Ones You Love. And so in that desire to maintain that relationship between people, you bring in all the emotional connections you have with them in an arena in which you should be making rational decisions. So it's very hard to do in many cases. So people evolve sometimes from the small business, their rules and relationships, And one family I know here in San Francisco, a dry cleaner establishment, their rule is when they get out of the car at home, the business ends, except in rare cases. So they've evolved. They've realized through practice that at a certain point you had to stop the business and you had to become a family again. How you make decisions in the business when you have those two kids you're talking about earlier, you have to choose between them. It's very difficult, I think, and not all businesses do that well.
Is structure then something, Lulu Caccini, that you need, that you can't make assumptions? Well, it's my son. Of course he understands that you have to have a more structured situation.
I think most businesses come to realize that. I think also most businesses start by saying, and Dennis points it out in his book, they start by saying, well, trust and love and connection is enough, and usually it isn't enough. So most of our effort at USF is in the classroom. It's, I might call it public health or preventive medicine, and we're trying to orient and alert and sensitize young students, 18, 19-year-old students who are just beginning to develop themselves, individuate, I guess is the psychological term, and separate from their parents and all that, and recognize that there are rational connections and ways to look at things and not just emotional connections. And sometimes, of course, they want to separate totally from their parents and the business, which they shouldn't do, but it's a reaction to maybe being too much immersed in it as kids. So we try to build that in and help our students think about, if you go back to the business or you're part of the business, what are the rules and what are the benchmarks and what are the best practices that can make the business successful? A lot of those connected to relationships.
Lulu Caccini is an adjunct professor and research associate at the Gellert Family Business Center at the University of San Francisco. He joins us along with Kent Rhodes, visiting professor of leadership and ethics at Pepperdine University and an associate with the Family Business Consulting Group. We're going to bring in our first business guest in just a moment. But Kent Rhodes, give us an example. When you're called in to consult a particular problem, what's the most common thing you get called in to troubleshoot, and how do you then try to address that?
Well, a couple of things. Succession planning is a really common call that I get. People are to the point that they all of a sudden realize that they need to talk more seriously about how to hand the company over to the next generation and realize that it's not just about handing over the finances and the structure of the company itself, but also about what the family means and because there is the tie between the family and the business. And so we work with them to do that. But I also
About handing over an idea, right?
Totally.
Something that's close to your heart.
Absolutely. So we talk a lot about the vision and mission of the business, which is usually very clear, but the vision and mission of the family may not be so clear. And so to help them actually create those kinds of structures and even think about policies. I mean, a lot of times I get called in when a company has experienced a great deal of growth, and the family is sort of like a fish out of water. They may not have had any formal training to run a business, and yet all of a sudden they're successful.
And it may no longer be enough to just have your brother-in-law be the HR guy or the IT person.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Let's bring in Mary-Les Casto now. She is the founder and CEO of Casto Travel, which is the largest privately held travel management company in Northern California and largest travel agency in the Bay Area. Mary-Les Casto, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I know you are just in the middle of, or recently at least, went through the process that Kent Rhodes was describing, which was making that transition, right? Handing the business over to your son. Was that tough to do?
Actually, no. I was really hoping from when I started the business that one day maybe Mark might join, but I never pressured him. I never even thought that he really would until he decided. But Mark and I really had a deal. Mark said, I would join the company only if you could answer one question. And I said, what is that? He said, can you fire me if I do not perform? And I said, absolutely, because this is not really, I mean, we're family, but this is a business. We run a business. And so we've kind of made sure that we stay focused on that. And when Mark joined us about 8 years ago, after 3 years, I think, or 4 years, he went through first all the steps, the finance, the marketing, the sales. And finally, he called me one day. He wanted to have a meeting. And so he said, well, Mom, I want to tell you that I think I'm ready. And so when he said that, I knew that Mark then, you know, felt that he earned it. And I really, truly respected Mark, and I knew Mark was the right person. And so I said, okay. And so Mark became the president of the company. and is doing a tremendous job. And I can honestly say I think it's better than I am.
And Kent Rhodes, would in this sort of situation, is it also important to realize for someone like Mary Les Casto, if Mark had not been ready, to be able to say, you know, I'd love to have this be something that's a family enterprise, but I really don't think that my son or daughter is going to be the right person.
Yeah, I think that this scenario is ideal for there to be a son who's interested and who prepares himself and is able then to come to a parent and say, I think I'm ready, and it be true. I think more often what ends up happening is sort of what you described earlier. Someone's in a position as the company grows and hasn't really trained themselves and hasn't kept up, hasn't been able to keep up with the growth of the company, and therefore are not quite ready to take over leadership. And so at that point, conversations about what ought to be put in place to help them be able to attain that becomes really important.
And Mary Les Casto, has Mark taken the company in a different direction? Is Casto Travel now something that's different than what you had once imagined?
Yes, he has. And I think in many ways the company has evolved. I mean, we started the business 34 years ago, and I had two people. Now we are over 200 people, and, you know, we're,
wow.
And you know, we're over $200 million in sales. And so the company has grown. But also being in the travel business, there are so many different challenges that we have, where I really tend to focus on the customer relations. Mark has a lot of knowledge in the technology side, and as well as, you know, the whole leadership. But I'm not very good in that part of the business, and we're talking about internet and you know, how you adopt the internet. And that's where really Mark's expertise come, and the people that he has surrounded himself with, his team, are really moving the company in the next generation and the next future. So I'm very excited about that because I couldn't have done it.
Mary Les Casto, the founder of Casto Travel. I'm glad you didn't have to fire your son. Thanks for being part of our program.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Lou Lucchini, that brings in an interesting question, too, which is sort of, she was speaking about complementary skills, and that must be an important factor in this, too, and to not be too insular, to make sure that you do have the right number of skills to make this business work.
Well, I think the business itself has to know what the key success ingredients are, and I think someone like Mark, it was entering the business, there needs to be a discussion early, if possible, about where Mark should be developing his expertise and whether he should even be developing that outside the business initially so that he can make his mistakes on somebody else's nickel and he can get honest and open feedback that's not going to involve like a mother-son relationship, and he's going to see what the competition is doing. A lot of reasons to take that first step maybe outside the business and then talk and have a negotiation between mother and son or whoever it is as to what terms he might come into the business and what his career path might be in the business.
That makes a lot of sense. Is that something you encourage when you're consulting, Kent Rhodes, to have people serve an apprenticeship in a non-family situation and then come back in later?
I do. I really work with families to help them decide for themselves what makes the most sense, and often that's the case. And usually there's an educational component that comes into play as well. So the family might say, you know, if you want to come back and work in the company, you need to go to school, and you need to get this kind of degree, and then you need to work someplace else for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then come back in.
What about your ability to adapt and change? The travel agency, of all things, is an example of something that's changed enormously, and I would think there would be a problem with family business being sometimes maybe a little too insular, a little too unwilling, perhaps, to adapt and change and to see how other people are doing things. Is that a concern? Lou, look at you.
Yeah, that, I think that's the challenge of any new person coming into a family business or any next generation coming in. You have the founder with their ideas and with their experience and the success that wants keeps them wanting to repeat what they've been doing and maybe not the skills. As Mary Les mentioned, she doesn't have the technology skills that her son brings in. So they have to come in with new ideas without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as you say. They have to be able to make a change.
And yet other times, I think that's really true, but it's important to remember that all of these people are entrepreneurs. They've started companies, and so they're not usually legacy companies, even if they're in second and third generations. There's still that entrepreneur thread that runs through that sometimes really serves them in being able to be nimble and move with the economy.
Joining us next is Mary Everett. She is the owner of Everett and Jones Barbecue Restaurant, which is a family-run restaurant in the East Bay. Seven restaurants locally all also sell their special barbecue sauce. She runs the Berkeley restaurant, which is on San Pablo Avenue. Mary Everett, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, you're in an interesting situation because it's you and your sisters who are running the business now, having taken it over from your late mother. Has that been a particular challenge, and is there sort of this sense of, well, this is what mom would have done? How do you sort of sort that out between your siblings?
Well, it's just that we just continue on the way that our mother had, you know, planned on us to do it. And so far, we haven't had a problem with it.
Do you ever have sort of disputes that you have to settle between your siblings? Is there one sibling that's first among equals? How do you sort that out?
Oh, yeah, we always have that. especially with it being eight girls and one boy. But in the end, it always seems to work out. It's always one sister that's real strong-headed more than the other ones. But once we all come together, it seemed to work out pretty good.
Do you have different specialties? I mean, are you someone who specializes in one aspect of the business and another sister specializes in something else? How do you sort of separate out those roles?
Yeah, well, I'm the one that specialize in keeping it as original, just as my mom had it. And then the other sisters, they have it where they have it, want to take it to another level and bigger and better ideas and adding more things to the menu. But I'm the one that kind of keep it simple.
And do you each have some independence then? Each of your restaurants has a different, is each sister's turf?
Yes. Each one of us own our own different restaurants.
And what about the next generation? What about your sons and daughters? Do you hope that Everett and Jones continues on within the family?
Oh, yes. My son right now, Shamar, he's into looking to open up his restaurant. So, and all the children are. All the next generation, that's their goal, to open up at Everett and Jones.
Yeah, secret. And
we encourage them.
Yeah, secret. I won't ask you for the secret of the sauce, but what's the secret of your success? Maybe the secret of the sauce.
Oh, I never will tell the secret of the sauce. Then you'll have Everett and Jones. But the secret to success is keeping it simple and being consistent.
Mary Everett, the owner of the Everett and Jones Barbecue Restaurant. She runs the one on Berkeley, on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley. Mary Everett, thanks very much for being part of the program this
morning.
Thank
you. You have a good day.
Thank you. You as well. Let's talk about what we heard from Mary Everett, Kent Rhodes, and Lou Lucaccini. First, this idea that this is sort of handy, you know, there's seven siblings and seven restaurants. Is that a particularly useful thing, Kent Rhodes, that each person has their own turf?
Yeah, clearly. I think that it probably serves them really well because it sounds like they have their individual small businesses and then come together. And I think that's one of the things that was key to what she mentioned there, and that is that when the women all come together to make decisions, it all works out. And I think that's really key. And it's actually to their credit that even though they're spread out across seven restaurants, that they sound like they make time to do that.
And how, though, if you didn't have seven restaurants, if this was seven siblings within one restaurant, let's say, what then do you have to begin to sort out? How do you handle who's in charge of what? I've got the menu, you've got the kitchen, all that sort of stuff. Lou?
Well, these things can happen by accident or by design. In some of the better families and firms, there's a procedure and a process for selecting people for the roles. With our students, we try to encourage them. We have a very serious program of career testing and ability assessment in which they try to identify their own roles and whether if they were to go back into the business, for instance, they might go back in the legal department as opposed to into sales or production or whatever it might be. I think in sorting things out, though, the key point is that they do get together once in a while and talk about it. And to go back to our dry cleaners, this fellow and his wife run two establishments, and they have, along with the dental appointments and everything on the calendar, they have a quarterly retreat they take with each other. They go to a trade show. They spend a couple of days on a vacation, and they assess the state of the business and talk about roles and activities and all that. And so they have set aside a time every quarter to reflect on roles and activities and how the business is doing and to make decisions for the next quarter. So they run a very rational business, probably more rational than many family businesses, but it's an ideal model for a lot of standpoints.
If you have a family-owned business that's started by one individual, passes it on, let's say, to three daughters, can those three daughters, Kent Rhodes, run the company jointly, or inevitably does one daughter have to be the person in charge?
Not necessarily. I think that that is such an individual decision, and it is my family personality, if I can use that phrase. But what I've seen is what is key is for those three daughters to come together, and usually it helps for them to have a facilitated process, whether it's a professor or a consultant, it doesn't matter, or a family friend, someone to come in and be able to facilitate the conversation about how they can work together best and how they're going to agree together. So coming up with some more formal ways of how we're going to work with each other and be very specific about that and commit to staying with that.
And what about when there are problems? What about, the sister, daughter who just isn't cutting it? What do you do then?
That happens. That happens all the time. And one of the pieces of work that I do is help families actually create processes and procedures to try to stave that off so that they create a policy that says, here are the performance measures that we're choosing to use and apply to ourselves.
So just as important to do performance reviews in a family business than in a company like KQED or any other?
Absolutely. But the key is that the family themselves need to make those decisions and all agree to apply them to themselves. And that way, when the time comes that someone is not performing, they can go back to that policy and say, well, this is what we agreed on, and so we need to act accordingly based on that. That helps take the emotion that is inevitable out of the equation just a little bit.
What have you seen with that, Lou Lucaccini, those sorts of tensions and the best way to resolve them? And do sometimes I assume people just have to agree to leave, to go their separate ways? I suppose at some point you can't just say, this is the family business, it must continue no matter what.
Well, it's always in life, it's an alignment of interests, emotional interests, mm-hmm. and economic interests and self-satisfaction. And if things aren't working out and third-party intervention that Kent is talking about doesn't solve the situation, then usually there is a break in the business and people separate out. You see it in the newspapers with the Pittsburgh Steelers, where the brothers are now discussing what's the best use of the capital. And I think the current manager wants his son to take over the business. And so they're at an impasse, and they may or may not resolve that thing.
Do you have to, Kent Rhodes, at some point in a family business not be quite as profitable? In other words, does the family part come back in at a certain point and say, we could make more money going that way, but what's in the best interest of the family is something else, where you have to have a value that's about continuity and compassion, perhaps, more than just the bottom line?
Well, yes, absolutely. I would say so, but it's in our experience that that families that actually go through that process and think through that, the business actually improves.
Hmm.
So it's almost like if you really do the right thing for the family, it improves the business. And the reverse axiom is true as well. If you make decisions that are based on what will help the business, the family also, the relationships within the family will improve.
Kent Rhodes is an visiting professor of leadership and ethics at Pepperdine University and an associate with the Family Business Consulting Group. He joins us this hour along with Lou Lucaccini, adjunct professor and research associate at USF's Gellert Family Business Center. We're going to take a short break, and here's the phone number if you want to join us from your family business, or if you're thinking about starting one, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your questions at forum, if you want to stay anonymous, forum@kqed.org. We'll be back with more on this topic, and a couple of other family business owners will join us as well. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, family business, the ins and outs of how they work. How can you make sure they're successful? How do you handle difficult problems when they come up, when that employee of yours is not just your employee, but perhaps your son, daughter, spouse, in-law, whatever. Our guests this hour include Lou Lucaccini, who's adjunct professor and research associate at the University of San Francisco's Gellert Family Business Center, and Kent Rhodes, visiting professor of leadership and ethics at Pepperdine and also an associate with the Family Business Consulting Group. We're going to hear from a couple of other small business owners, family business owners, in just a bit, but we welcome your questions and participation in our program today, especially if you're calling from a family business or thinking about starting one. We'd welcome your consideration in our program. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. We were talking a little bit before the break, Kent Rhodes, about problems in dealing with conflict and what if one brother, sister, son, daughter isn't quite doing well and how you resolve that. I'm wondering about communication as well. You'd like to think at a certain level, I suppose, that because it's a family business, communication would be good. But we all know from our own family experiences that communication isn't necessarily always good. How do you counsel people in that regard?
Well, a lot of it is about just helping surface old patterns. Obviously, especially if they're sibling teams that are working together, they're probably relying on communication patterns that they established when they were 5, 6, 7 years old. And sometimes they surface exactly in the same way. So helping raise the level of understanding about that and then helping them create new strategies around that that are unique to them, that work for them. It certainly isn't a therapy process, but it's literally about giving new strategies and tools.
Well, we have a sibling partnership that we're going to bring onto our program next. Steve Radford joins us. He's Senior Vice President of Radford Surveys and Consulting, which for more than 30 years has provided compensation market intelligence to the technology and life sciences industry. Steve Radford runs the business with his twin brother, not only a sibling, but a twin, Brother John. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Dave.
Now, I see here that you're the senior vice president. Does that mean that John is the senior president?
Yes, he's 4 minutes older than I am, so he takes charge.
And how do you divide that up between the two of you? And what are some of the things you've had to work your way through? It sounds like if you've been doing it for 30 years, you've figured it out.
No, we get along great. You have to define the roles and who has the power. That typically comes from your early relationship as children. We came from a family where we were all very close and worked together. And then you just go ahead and make sure you're doing your job. He started as a business manager. I was a product manager. We both were in sales, and we knew what we were supposed to do, and we went out and did it.
So is that the key, to both have different talents, but to understand that and accept that and recognize that?
Absolutely. You have to know what you're good at and what you're not and what you're supposed to do. You have to make sure there's clear communication and trust. You should try to have somewhat of a sense of a humor, and you have to really be able to handle the tough times.
And tell us about that. Have there been tough times, and how have you dealt with them?
Yes, but if you've been raised like most families, you've been through tough times before. You have a track record of it. You know how people will react and what they do. So to be quite honest with you, business, the tough times didn't really seem so bad. You just know how to get through them. You know, there's a challenge facing you, and you tackle it head on.
And what about your that brother who's 4 minutes older? Are you able to separate your relationship with your brother as your brother and your relationship with your brother as your business partner?
Yes, but the family-owned business does have a unique environment. We try to create something that's really family-friendly where people feel it's an open-door policy. You can come and chat with us anytime. We don't take it home. We do separate it from there, but people know the founders, and they know that that's how they are, and we're very different people. We do different things and work in different fashions.
And what about what comes next? Presumably you don't both have twin daughters or sons, but have you thought about, I'm sure you have, what's going to happen with the Radford business beyond you and your brother John?
Well, my daughter and son refuse to work here, so that's not an option. We have a niece that may consider it, but to be serious about it, we built a core of great talent at Radford. We treat them like family, and we're looking at the succession planning, as Kent and Lou referred to, and who's going to take over different roles and make sure we groom them appropriately.
Steve Radford, the Senior Vice President of Radford Surveys and Consulting. Steve, thanks very much for your contributions.
Thank you.
What do you hear that they're doing right, Kent Rhodes?
Well, clearly, I loved what he said about building trust and communication and keeping a sense of humor. I think that those are really key elements. And obviously, he and his brother, and maybe the fact that they're twins helps this process a little bit. But I would say that that is exactly what they're doing right.
And it also sounds like, Lulu Caccini, they haven't had this predestined plan that it must stay in the family, that Steve was perfectly fine with the idea that his own son and daughter weren't necessarily going to take this forward.
It sounds like they have a very objective approach to that. And I wonder if they've established criteria or a process where the kids might dabble in the business enough to be able to make their own decisions without feeling that pressure. A lot of our students come in feeling that pressure, often unspoken. If the first time it's really spoken to them that they're entering the business is when their dad tells them to sign up for the family business class and they didn't know why, and it occurs to them, it all begins then to come out. And so that's at the point at which we talk to them about a process of communication and ways to raise these topics with their parents.
Let's get some of our listeners engaged in the discussion this morning. Nicole in San Francisco joins us first. Nicole, go ahead, please. Nicole, are you with us?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I actually, my parents started a business when I was 5 years old, and I'm now 21. And they got a divorce when I was about 16. And it's still pretty messy because they're still trying to divide up the business.
Mm.
And this is a business that went home with us. When I was sick, I went to the office, and I had a sleeping bag next to the file cabinet.
Wow.
So this was very much a big part of our family, and it drove a huge wedge when there was the divorce because it seemed to me like my father cared more about the business and my mother cared more about us kids. And so I'm just wondering what advice you have for people who are starting up their businesses and have children, what they should do when they don't realize that they're consumed more by the business than they are by their kids.
Nicole, thank you. Thanks very much for bringing that to us. This really cuts to the heart of a lot of different things, both how you keep appropriate boundaries, Kent Rhodes, and then, of course, how you contend when there is a divorce in the family.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where one of the things we try to do, it's difficult to back into it sometimes, but help families think through worst-case scenarios. And no one wants to do that. That's really painful. And no one expects there to be a divorce. And no one ever plans for the business to become more important than the children, at least from the children's standpoint. So helping them think through, even if it's a generational thing, so for the next generation, what can we do to actually help prevent this from repeating itself, which sometimes happens in families.
And Nicole was also talking about, in addition to, of course, the pain of divorce and how divorce in this case not only affects family but also livelihood between her parents, she was also raising this question that in family businesses, and I bet this is true, it can be really consuming, that you don't ever leave the office behind because family and office can be synonymous. So what do you advise along those lines? Because it sounds like from Nicole's point of view that she paid a price for that.
Yeah, it sounded like that as well. And I think that, again, it gets back to the key of being able to adequately separate what is the business and what is the family, and to pay adequate attention to what the family's getting and not getting, and being able to create strategies around that. But it takes conversations about that, and the family needs to come together, actually, and ask those kind of questions.
Bonnie is next in San Francisco. Bonnie, go ahead.
To comment actually on this exact topic. My husband and I own a business together. We have two small kids, and one of the negotiations that we had to have when we were deciding to go into business together was how we were going to divide the work of the business with the work of a family.
Yeah.
And we had many conversations about that, and actually we came up with some really good boundaries that work well for us.
And what are those?
Well, one is we never discuss business at the dinner table. So at the dinner table, we're talking with our kids about their day and what's going on with them. We have another rule that we never discuss business before we go to bed or while we're in bed. So once we are, you know, 30 minutes before we're going to go to bed, we can't talk about it anymore. We talk about personal stuff or whatever else we want.
And how's it sounds like you've got the family rules figured out. How's the business part going?
The business part's going great. We did what a previous caller, I think, referred to, which is we very clearly defined our own areas where we were going to be working. So we're not actually working on the same projects. We're working more parallel than we are intersecting. and because we have different strengths and different areas of expertise. So this allows us to sort of do our own thing and support each other as a cheerleader and a colleague, but not get into these conflicts about style. You know, why didn't you do it this way? I would have done this. Why say this? You know, because as a married couple, you know, you can do that until the cows come home.
Right, Bonnie.
Won't get you anywhere.
Bonnie, thanks. Thanks for your contribution to the program. Lulu Guccini, it sounds like they've figured out quite a lot, and there must be special challenges with spouses running a company in particular.
Well, I think the first challenge is the statistics on divorce, which show that half the marriages in this country do end up in divorce. And so the initial question, I guess, for any enterprise is ultimately, what's your exit strategy? And in the case of a couple, what would your exit strategy be in case of a divorce? How would you handle that? And how would you handle the business? So those discussions probably need to be held right at the beginning. It's a kind of a pessimistic way to look at going into business, but realistic at the same time.
It seems like such common sense, the point Bonnie made, Kent Rhodes, about we're talking to the kids at the dinner table, not about the business. We're talking to each other when we go to bed, not about the business. And yet, is that something that you find yourself having to say to people, that they aren't able to make that separation?
You know, it really is. Bonnie is not the rule. She's an exception, and that's great. I hope that becomes more of an accepted standard practice, because it is. We have to help people understand and set those kind of boundaries for themselves.
Tommy writes in, my sister is part of a family business owned by an aunt and uncle, a restaurant that everybody assumes they bought to give their sons something to do after college. She's a manager and holds some authority, but really wants to move the company toward a fine dining atmosphere. One brother has the same idea, while the other wants to make it more of a bar experience. The aunt and uncle are sort of staying out of the debate because they're not in it for the long term. What advice do you have?
That's a good question. If you're asking what I would do if I met with his family, I think that what I would recommend is that they, again, sit together and think a little bit more in terms about what kind of vision they can come together with for the restaurant. Obviously, the differences are there. But if they can come up with a broader vision that they can at least hang some of their ideas on, and then come up with either a compromise or somehow agree to that. But those are very real situations that have to be worked out for sure.
And, I mean, there are two problems, really. It's agreeing on the vision, but it also sounds like, in this case, Lulu Guccini, that it's not clear who's exactly in charge, that there's a lot of fuzziness about who's in charge of what.
Well, the question, a major question in any family business or any enterprise is who has effective control. And it seems like control, as you're pointing out, is floating in the middle of this four or five person arrangement here. Ownership may be with the aunt and uncle, and then there's a manager and there are two kids. John and Steve apparently have worked out control. Maybe it's 50-50, or maybe one brother has control and the other has accepted a secondary role. But those issues need to be settled. And then around control comes the decision-making through group meetings and so on.
Jonathan joins us next in San Anselmo this morning. Jonathan, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. And I would first like to commend your professionals there, most critically, Lulu Guccini, who's been a dear friend and someone I admire for many, many years in his business acumen. Hello there, Lou.
Hello.
It's Jonathan. So I wanted to just comment on a couple of things that I've seen take place in family business. And in my history, my father working for my grandfather, I found that my father seemed to be held to a considerably higher level, a higher standard level than those around him in similar capacity, which seemed to develop a rift between the two of them. So I'd like to have somebody comment on that, as well as the fact that because of the youth of today are coming in with such a greater sense of technology, I do feel like, and I see this happening around me, that those bringing in younger members of the family have to expand their awareness and their ability to embrace the new technology, which may fly in the face of the traditional way that they've run their business and relinquishes a certain amount of control to their children, but ultimately stands to benefit the business.
Jonathan, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call. Lulu Guccini, on the first point that he observed this sort of rift developing, and I bet that's not uncommon either in a family business, that if your son is your employee and there are 14 other employees, that you have special expectations and you hold that son to a different standard.
I think many of the students we've worked with that are from a family business feel that they are held to a higher standard by their parents. And part of that is because of the impact and the example that sets for other employees.
And what do you do about that? How do you sort that out?
Well, we try to make students aware of that and hold conversations around it. But it's a pretty much a fact of life, and I think students have come to accept that that is the case, and that there are those expectations, and there always will be. Discussion, communication, approaching your parents in the right way. I think another issue, related issue that Jonathan brings in, is that someone entering a family business, a family member, needs to have their own area of expertise. Often it's technology, and that helps give them a little space. So the parent not having that technology expertise, in a way, may give them, if they don't fight about it, may give them a little more separation, and it may give the newcomer a little more authority with the other members of the business.
We've all had the experience that our 20-something children are a lot smarter than we are, people of my generation, about all things technological. Kent Rose, can it work, though, in the other way around? Can sometimes the 25-year-old think, oh, man, you know, my parents don't know anything, and that creates a problem because they're so much sharper than their folks are?
It does create a problem sometimes, but there's as much about this about letting go. It's both for parents, if they're actually going to bring in a younger generation, that, you know, they actually might know more. And so the parents might need to be aware of that and to give them space to actually and step back and let that younger generation actually step in, do their work, bring in new technology, and make a difference in the business.
Linda joins us next in Youngstown, Ohio. And sounds like, Linda, you might be sort of sorting through some of these same questions.
Yes. I work for my daughter. She started a business 4 years ago, and I said that I would work for her for a few years, and here I am still working for her. And how we handle this is it's her business.
Uh-huh. Oh, sorry.
Happened.
We're losing you a bit, Linda. Try once more.
Okay, I stand back and allow things to happen, even if I know that she's making a mistake. And I don't offer my opinion unless she asks for it. We have a rule that we don't talk about business at family functions. The only place that we discuss business is on the business premise or on occasion on the phone a couple of times during the day because it's a business that runs in the evenings. So, and that's it. You know, we get along very well with it. I defer to her. I listen to whatever it is that she wants to do, and I mean, if I disagree with it, I'll let her know that I disagree, but the bottom line is it is her business.
Linda, thank you. Thanks very much for your contributions. Sounds like, Kent Rose, that Linda's sort of got this down, but that must be quite a challenge because it's not the norm to say, well, daughter, you're the boss.
Well, of course, in her situation, the daughter actually is the boss, and I appreciate very much that she's got that clear in her head. I think that what happens more often than not is, especially just imagine there is that grandparents that started a company and they've handed down, and they're actually talking about their grandchildren handing things over and letting them run the company, and literally figuring out ways to step back and yet still be supportive grandparents and step back even when they think their mistakes are being made, to let them make those mistakes, because first of all, that's how they're going to learn, and also to remember that they made mistakes as well, and still the company was successful.
Let's bring in one more family business owner and see how they're contending with that question. Amelia Seha joins us next of Seha Vineyard, which is a Napa winery. And Amelia Seha, thanks very much for being part of our program on the point we were just talking about, and that is dealing with when you think that maybe whether it's your son, daughter, spouse, whoever is making a mistake. How do you contend with that in your situation?
Well, in our case at Seha Vineyards, we always allow the principals to help solve issues. And fortunately, we've been able to not make mistakes. And even though it's hard often, often it's we are angry or our egos get in the way. Ultimately, we all want achieve the same goal, to grow our business. So it's just talking about it, and often we raise our voices, but But, you know, at the end, we all collectively work towards the same goal.
And is that something that you sometimes have brought someone else in, an outside consultant, to kind of remind you of that? Or do you really keep all of it in-house?
We have kept, you know, all of our, from the foundation up to now, all in-house. And it's, you know, there are four principals that they have in here. I'm the president, Pedro. My husband is the secretary. His brother, Armando, is the CFO, in addition to being the vineyardist and winemaker. And Marta, Armando's wife, is the vice president. And we all have, you know, own 25%, so we all have equal votes. And we have a, we require a quorum of three votes to do anything. And that's, it's actually quite easily achieved.
Yeah. Amelia Ceja of Ceja Vineyards in the Napa area. Thanks very much for contributing to our program this morning.
Well, thank you for your invitation.
Kent Rhodes, on that last question, it's interesting. They've divided this up. They each have very separate roles. They each own a quarter of the company, but it takes three. Is that important to do, to have sort of very specific roles, but also a method for how you're going to come to decisions?
Absolutely. I think that the way Amelia described that is ideal, that they've actually come to agreements with each other. And again, I think it gets back to that. What kind of agreements do we need to put into place? And I would even say that later on, there might even be agreement around what kind of education do we need to give ourselves as we move to the next level as the company grows and develops.
John in Cleveland, Ohio, joins us next. John, go ahead with your question or observation.
Well, I took over a family business, second-generation hotel, and my brother, who was an older brother in an Italian family, he went out to be a carpenter. And even though we had the same education, I took over the business. Later on, I started a construction business. I brought my brother in as an equal partner, but did not make provisions for him to put in any equity. So what's happening now is he's treating the job as a job and not like a partner and not like a working partner. In other words, he wants to get his full salary. He doesn't want to put anything in. And I wish I would have thought a little bit ahead, you know, to give him that entrepreneurial incentive.
John, thanks. Thanks for the cautionary tale. Lou Lucaccini, a response?
Well, setting up control is important. We talked about that. And the balance of control is also important. Three out of four votes is okay. When it's two out of two, there's a problem. 51-49 is an important ratio to preserve, and certainly the investment of somebody's capital in a business to cause that energy and growth, the potential for growth, is important to see too.
Could it be the other way around, Kent Rhodes? John is describing a situation where he wished his brother was more invested, but could you look at it the other way around, that it's okay to have someone in a family business, even though they're your brother or a son or daughter, to just have it be a job?
Absolutely. And in fact, we've worked with several clients that we've worked through that exact same scenario, where there's a family member that just wants to be an individual who has a job there. But it also does work the other direction, too, of what is the difference between being an owner who may not be employed. What are the responsibilities and roles there? Whether or not they have voting shares, whether or not they have how much stock they have. So some really important questions around motivation and involvement of family members.
Where do you go to get advice? I mean, you're part of a consulting company. You're both teaching. But is there help out there? I mean, where do people with family businesses, if they want to sort of sort out these knotty, difficult, interesting problems, where do they go?
Well, I was going to say there are lots of ways to do it. The thing we recommend first for our students is to have their own board of personal advisors even before they're out of school, which makes their parents nervous when they want to know about want the family attorney's name at the age of 18. But any business should have outside advisors or a board of directors as one source. There are professional consultants, very skilled, like Kent, for instance. There's an organization, international organization, called the Family Firm Institute, which is composed of a number of businesses and consultants. There are also educational programs built around universities and schools. Financial institutions offer courses. And then your peer groups and your neighborhood groups, if you're a retail establishment and so on. There are a number of sources if you want to find them.
Let's get in one more caller. Phyllis, you're next. I'm afraid we're short on time, so just a quick question, please.
Yes. My shortest question, our business is not as happily run as everything that I heard. I think it's much more complicated. But, you know, we love each other, and that's the most important thing. My main question is I worry terribly. I've worked about 35 years in my life. I've given it most of it to my son. He's now been doing it for 8 years. He probably, by the time I die, will have done it God knows how many years. With the estate tax of 55%, our whole business would be torn apart. And what would happen? It's just a problem that's there. Hmm. What would happen when people have worked, your children, for 10, 15 years at the same business and multiplied it, and also are then exposed to that enormous tax which rips the building apart because of the whole business, because you don't have these 55%.
Yeah, Phyllis, to interject. Yeah, we're running short on time. You've raised an important question. Kent Rhodes, take a quick flyer at it.
Absolutely, we really encourage families to develop trust. Family trusts actually provide some protection around those kinds of things, and also help create structures and strategies around how wealth that the family has will be distributed. So it's a good way to address some of those issues.
Last bit of quick advice, if someone is going to go off this weekend and think about the family business they have been dreaming about all their life, what would you advise? Where do you start?
I say go for it. I think it's a great thing. There's some stats that show that 90% of companies in this country are family-owned, or at least to have that kind of as a basis. But I would say to ask the really hard questions. Think about, how do we want to engage with each other in areas that we may not have ever thought about before, and try to anticipate some of those things that create policies and procedures that right now seem unnecessary, but they will be.
Kent Rhodes joins us this hour. He's visiting professor of leadership and ethics at Pepperdine University and an associate with the Family Business Consulting Group. Thanks for being on our program, Kent.
You're welcome.
And Lulu Caccini was here as well, adjunct professor and research associate at USF's Gellert Family Business Center. Lou, thank you.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Kevin Guillory, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.